The U.S. Defense Secretary puts Iran-backed militias on notice.
It's time to take away even more capability than we've taken in the past.
The EU votes to give Ukraine 50 billion euros.
These 50 billion euros for 4 years also send a very strong message to Putin, just ahead of the second anniversary of his brutal invasion.
And the U.S. territory where Chinese nationals can visit without having to get a visa.
The Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, or CNMI. It's a collection of islands in the Pacific Ocean, a U.S. territory that is far removed from Washington, D.C.
Today is Friday, February 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. forces are preparing to hit Iranian-backed proxies across the Middle East with increased intensity in response to a drone attack that killed 3 U.S. soldiers and injured more than 40 others. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has the latest from the Pentagon.
U.S. forces have yet to respond to the attack on the Tower 22 base in northeastern Jordan that hit troops as they slept. But U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the response is coming and that it will be felt.
It's time to take away even more capability than we've taken in the past.
Speaking to reporters for the first time since he returned to work after complications from prostate cancer surgery, Austin promised a multi-tiered response and seemed to dismiss talk from some of the militias that they're done attacking U.S. forces.
We always listen to what people are saying, but we watch what they do. Actions are everything.
Austin also dismissed concerns from some critics that the Pentagon is telegraphing its moves, giving the Iranian proxy forces time to hide.
They have a lot of capability. I have a lot more. As I said earlier, we're going to do what's necessary to protect our troops and our interests.
Iranian-backed militias in Iraq and Syria have carried out at least 166 attacks on U.S. forces since mid-October. The militias say they're acting in solidarity with Palestinians, pointing to the nearly four-month-long war between Israel and Hamas militants in Gaza, sparked by the Hamas terror attack on Israel October 7th. The U.S. Defense Secretary also promised to keep up the pressure on Houthi militants in Yemen, who have likewise pointed to Gaza as the reason for launching some 40 attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden.
Our goal is to make sure that we continue to take away capability from the Houthis to do what they've been doing.
Lloyd Austin called the Houthi attacks irresponsible and illegal. The U.S. designated the Houthis as a terror group last month. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
While those preparations are underway at the Pentagon, many U.S. lawmakers are concerned about increasing U.S. military involvement in the Middle East. Here's VOA's Catherine Gibson with that.
The deaths of 3 U.S. service members at a military base in Jordan on Sunday will not go unanswered, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin told reporters Thursday. Despite fears a U.S. response could escalate regional tensions.
So this is a dangerous moment in the Middle East. We will continue to work to avoid a wider conflict in the region. But we will take all necessary actions to defend the United States, our interests, and our people. And we will respond when we choose, where we choose, and how we choose.
Iran-backed militants have carried out 166 attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. Iran has denied responsibility for the attack that killed 3 U.S. service members and says it is not deterred by a potential U.S. response.
You know that we do not leave any threats unanswered. While we are not looking for war, we are not afraid of war, and we do not run away from it.
On Capitol Hill, some Democratic senators are concerned a U.S. response could rapidly escalate a military conflict before lawmakers have a chance to authorize war. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
This is an escalating war in the Middle East, the U.S. is getting drawn more and more into it. There's no congressional authorization for the U.S. participation in another war in the Middle East, so the time is probably now right for Congress to begin that discussion.
But lawmakers also recognize the need for a strong U.S. response. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin.
Anyone who attacks the troops and puts Americans in harm's way is going to do everything we can to defend our citizens and our troops especially. And let them know that this is not going to be tolerated and they'll have to pay extreme prices for it.
Earlier this week, top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell said the Biden administration's policies had increased the threat posed by Iran.
For 3 years, the threat of Iran-backed terror against American personnel and interests in the Middle East has been growing. Iran is emboldened and believes it can use its proxies to attack America with impunity. And the Biden administration has hastened this erosion of deterrence. Their public hand-wringing and fear of escalation sends exactly the wrong message to Tehran.
And other Republican lawmakers said Thursday any response should be carefully calibrated. Republican Senator Rick Scott.
I'd like to know the president has a plan to not just stop this, but to put Iran in a position they will never do this again.
The U.S. has responded to previous attacks on U.S. service members with actions including an October strike on a weapons storage site in Syria used by Iranian-backed militias. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Joining us now to talk about this is Daniel L. Davis, senior fellow and military expert at Defense Priorities. Davis retired from the U.S. Army as a lieutenant colonel after 21 years of active service. He was deployed into combat zones 4 times in his career, beginning with Operation Desert Storm in 1991, then to Iraq in 2009, and to Afghanistan twice. So the thing that strikes me, and maybe I just don't know enough to know, is that, you know, they keep saying, you know, we're going to retaliate. Now we're going to plan to retaliate. We've made up our mind on what we want to do to retaliate. Now we're going to have another news conference saying we're going to retaliate. Is that usual?
Well, I got to say, honestly, though, I think this one was like 90% Austin's coming out party to face the music. From the December fiasco, since that's like what nearly everybody was asking about. I think that was the primary purpose of this one, just to get that stuff out of the way so we can start getting back to regular stuff. But it's really a little bit broader than that. I mean, your question is still valid. Even outside of this, there has been a lot of signaling on this. And, there's been reports that many of the IRGC members in Syria have been withdrawn, and they've gone, especially the leaders, have gone back to Iran. So, you know, it's a valid question to say, well, you guys have been talking a lot about this and what you're doing, that you're going to hit targets outside of Iran. I mean, we've been a little more specific than I'm comfortable with, but I don't recall having seen this much, pre-signaling is even the right word, just continuing to talk about it day after day. I don't know that I've seen anything like this before.
Obviously, we're just speculating now, but do you think it's that they're really nervous about creating a wider war, or?
Well, I certainly hope so. If that's what's delaying them, then I'm all for it, because I've made a number of shows on my Daniel Davis Deep Dive YouTube show talking about, laying out the significant risk to the United States if this is not handled properly. And there's a whole bunch of ways this goes wrong if you start hitting Iranian targets, especially in large numbers, outside of like the Islamic Resistance of Iraq or Khatib Hezbollah, the people who we believe actually did this. Now, you hit them, you can hit them all day long and you can hit them hard. But when you start expanding into Iranian forces, even if you're outside of Iran, you start to run into all kinds of possibilities of this thing expanding. And that's one of my big problems with all this nonsense, all these people who are beating their chest about how we got to go hit Iran hard and, kill Iranians. And what, like Lindsey Graham said this afternoon, look, man, what next? What if they don't back down like you want them to? And I see no evidence that they would. But they don't ever answer that question. What happens if we do what you suggest? And not only do they not back down, but they escalate and they hit more American bases out there in the middle of nowhere in Iraq or Syria. Then what are you going to do? Go to war?
Well, and you've kind of seen that, haven't you, with the Houthis? Because, you know, they've hit them repeatedly, and they fired a missile today at a ship.
Yeah, and you didn't even need to see that. You see that the Houthis did this for like 9 years with Saudi Arabia, who had every technological advantage over them in the world, to include support from us, and they never were cowed. Why do you think they're going to be cowed now? So I hope that President Biden is starting to go, oh, hang on, I don't want to make this worse than it already is, and hopefully you're trying to find maybe a non-kinetic way out of this, or just limit it to Kataib Hezbollah or the Islamic Resistance of Iraq, and just, you know, and then get our troops out. Because that's the other thing that I'll point out that I don't hear anybody talking about. So it was just a matter of time. It was rolling the dice every day, and one finally got through.
So why are they there? Just because they're there and they don't want to pull them?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I think I publicly went on talked about this was in, I want to say it was May 2019 on Fox. And that's when Trump, maybe the third time when he said, I'm going to withdraw all the troops from Syria. And everybody went crazy. No, you can't do that. It'll cause vacuums and it'll hand a victory to, you know, fill in the blank, Russia, Iran, whatever. There's all these kinds of fears that it would, because nobody stops to think about the reality of what those handful of troops even do on the ground. They don't do anything. Those aren't combat troops there for the most part. These kids who were killed were engineers, reserve engineers at that. They're not combat troops. So everybody's afraid to withdraw. I mean, it took 20 years to get us out of Afghanistan, for crying out loud. And people to this day still argue. Petraeus did just the other day. I saw him like 2-3 days ago in one of the videos I saw. He said, I still think it was a mistake. We should still be in Afghanistan today. I cannot believe he said that with a straight face. And the anchor didn't even challenge him on it, but I do.
Sure.
It's just nonsense. But that's it. We just have this phobia about withdrawing from anywhere. Every time we would go somewhere, it's like we have to stay forever. When we left Iraq in 2011, everybody talked, or many people talked about how that was a mistake. And of course, when ISIS rose up, they said, aha, see, I told you we left and then this happened. That's not why ISIS arose. In fact, you can make a bigger argument that ISIS arose because we went there in 2003 and stayed as long as we did and fought that insurgency. That's a bigger likelihood of it. But you see that now once they went in there, they're still there today.
Daniel L. Davis with Defense Priorities in Washington. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said a unanimous decision by EU leaders to extend 50 billion euros in new aid to Ukraine on Thursday means Europe got stronger.
Today is indeed a very special day. The European Council reconfirmed Europe's unwavering commitment to stand with Ukraine. We all know that Ukraine is fighting for us. So we will support them with the necessary funding and provide them with the much-needed predictability they deserve. And I think these 50 billion euros for 4 years also send a very strong message to Putin, just ahead of the second anniversary of his brutal invasion.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he was grateful.
I'm grateful for your decision on the financial instrument for us. For our people, for Ukraine. Ukraine facility with 50 billion euros for a four-year period. This is a clear signal that Ukraine will withstand and that Europe will withstand. It is also really important that this decision was taken unanimously by all of you, all 27 member states. And it is yet another clear sign of your strong unity and support of Ukraine.
The agreement comes after weeks of wrangling with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who vetoed the aid package last December. Before the summit started, EU leaders piled pressure on Hungary to lift its block, telling Orban he had to pick sides in the existential challenge posed by Russia's war. Following these other stories from around the world, Facebook parent company Meta blew through expectations in announcing financial results a day after CEO Mark Zuckerberg took a beating at a U.S. Senate hearing. The company announced its first dividend just days ahead of Facebook's 20th anniversary. A malaria vaccine developed by the University of Oxford and the Serum Institute of India prevented about 3/4 of symptomatic malaria cases in young children in the first year after they got the shots. This is all according to results from a large trial released on Thursday. The vaccine has been approved for use by regulators in 3 West African countries and the World Health Organization. It is the second vaccine to become available this year. An asteroid as big as a skyscraper will pass within 1.7 million miles of Earth on Friday. Not to worry, however. There's no chance of it hitting us as it passes from 7 times the distance of the Earth to the Moon. NASA's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies estimates the space rock is between 210 meters and 480 meters across. It's about the size of New York City's Empire State Building. Low voter turnout is a persistent issue in Pakistan, where barely half the registered voters have cast their ballot in past general elections. Women lag far behind men. Social, economic, logistical hurdles prevent many from coming out on election day. VOA Islamabad bureau chief Sarah Zaman visited a village in Punjab province where a decision men made nearly a century ago still keeps women from voting.
Spring may just be around the corner in Pakistan's Punjab province, but election season is in full swing. In the small village of Dhurnal, however, the February 8 polls don't mean much to women. Years before Pakistan's creation, village elders here vowed women would not go out to vote. That promise, made in a mosque, was renewed in the 1960s. Haji Abdul Qayyum has run for district government.
The decision was made out of concern that if women are walking by and a stranger looks at them, it could cause a fight. It's not as if they didn't want to give women the right to vote.
Pakistan's current election laws require at least 10% of the vote in any constituency to come from women.
The larger constituency that Dhurnal is a part of did manage to reach that goal in the 2018 elections. However, the 3 polling stations set up in this village barely saw enough women show up.
Villagers insist there is not a formal ban on women voting, but say most don't go out of respect for tradition. Women in this room did not want to be identified.
We need to do laundry, wash dishes, cook at home. It's not suitable for women to dress up and go out to vote.
Others who would like to vote say they need moral support. In Dhurnal, mobilizing women can cost candidates, says Haji Abdul Qayyum.
If we break tradition, we lose voters.
Safiya Bibi, a government school teacher, casts her ballot by mail. She served as an election official in 2018 and will be at a local polling station next week to guide any women who may show up to vote.
Most welcome. I'm among those who help cast a vote, and I say it myself that they should vote.
But it's unlikely many will break tradition. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Dhurnal, Punjab, Pakistan.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. The Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, a U.S. territory in the Pacific, is the only place in the United States where Chinese nationals, Chinese citizens, can enter without a visa for up to 14 days. Now, some members of Congress want to shut that program down. Here's VOA's Jessica Stone.
The Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, or CNMI, it's a collection of islands in the Pacific Ocean, a U.S. territory that is far removed from Washington, D.C. Since 2019, the CNMI has offered Chinese nationals 14-day visa-free entry to help encourage tourism. CNMI Governor Arnold Palacios tells VOA the program made China a lucrative source of visitors.
Pre-pandemic, it was close to 45,000 to 48% of tourists that come to the Commonwealth are from mainland China. 185,000 people.
But Republican Representative Neil Dunn says the program opened a back door to Chinese citizens who are working on the islands illegally, selling drugs, or perhaps gathering intelligence on U.S. strategic military installations in the region.
It was an honest thing to try, but it was it becomes a loophole that the Chinese take advantage of.
In a letter to the Department of Homeland Security last year, Dunn and 31 other Republicans in Congress called for closing that loophole, demanding that Chinese nationals obtain a tourism visa to visit the islands. DHS did not respond to an email from VOA seeking a response to the letter. In addition to the visa issue, Palacios says he's also dealing with illegal entry into the region. In September, more than a dozen Chinese nationals were prosecuted for illegally trying to enter Guam by chartering a boat from the CNMI island of Saipan.
That's where Anderson Air Force Base is. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's reason to be concerned, obviously.
The department has proposed additional electronic screening, but still allows Chinese nationals to enter the CNMI for 2 weeks without a visa. The changes would begin later this year. Congressman Dunn says the proposal doesn't go far enough.
You can't do that. You can't allow anybody into an American territory without a visa, preferentially just because you want tourist business.
Palacios took office promising to reduce dependence on Chinese investment. He's trying to cultivate tourism from U.S. allies like Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. He says the territory lost as much as $1 billion when Chinese lockdowns prevented travelers from coming to Saipan. Palacios says he's asking Washington lawmakers to increase air routes to the territory and to stop illegal entry. He wants money to employ more locals to protect the homeland by sea and air. Jessica Stone, VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro continues its crackdown on the political opposition. This includes the arrest of members of the Democratic opposition and the barring of candidates from competing in this year's presidential election. These moves are inconsistent with the agreement signed in Barbados last October by representatives of President Maduro and the Unitary Platform, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a statement. Under the Barbados Agreement, representatives of President Maduro and several Venezuelan opposition parties, called the Unitary Platform, pledged to work toward free and fair elections in the second half of 2024. In support of the Barbados Agreement, the United States issued General License 44, which provides relief to Venezuela's oil and gas sector. Spokesperson Miller warned that absent progress between Maduro and his representatives and the opposition Unitary Platform, particularly on allowing presidential candidates to compete in this year's election, the United States will not renew the license when it expires on April 18, 2024. Additionally, the United States is revoking General License 43, which authorized transactions involving Minervan, the Venezuelan state-owned gold mining company. U.S. persons will have 14 days to wind down any transactions that were previously authorized by that license. The United States remains strongly committed to supporting dialogue between the parties and to the aspirations of the Venezuelan people for a democratic future. We will continue to work with the international community and all peaceful democratic actors across the political spectrum in Venezuela and leverage mechanisms at our disposal to encourage a return to the principles in the Barbados Agreement, said spokesperson Miller. The Barbados Electoral Roadmap Agreement remains the most viable mechanism to resolving Venezuela's long-standing political, economic, and humanitarian crisis, and realizing free and fair elections in Venezuela. but that will require Maduro and his representatives to uphold the roadmap's principles and ensure that opposition political actors have the right to select their candidates for the 2024 presidential election freely.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.